has Donald Trump really brought eternal peace to the Middle East? Why should you learn about an internal political dispute in a region in Bosnia? We're going to talk about this and much more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome to Trumpet World. We have a bit more of a basic, probably shorter show today. Our correspondents are scattered all over the world as we prepare to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So we're going to cancel next week's show, but we didn't want to leave you with no coverage for a fortnight. So each correspondent is recording their segment a little early, sending in a brief video message covering the important news from their region. First, we'll hear from Mihailo Zekic with an update from the Middle East.
Hello and welcome from not our Edstone studio. We're actually in the beautiful Dutch countryside for a little sneak preview. We'll be having a special episode on location at The Hague, the Netherlands seat of government coming up. But first, for this week in review, we'll speak about what's going on in the Middle East. United States President Donald Trump on September 29th announced a 20-point peace plan for Israel and Gaza. He's been alluding to this since he got into office, but this is the first time we actually have a comprehensive blow-by-blow official plan on to end the war. What are some of the details? Well, Gaza would be de-radicalized, again, assuming Hamas agrees to this. Israel will agree to end the war. It would withdraw its troops to an agreed-upon line, which would lead to the release of all the hostages Hamas still has in captivity. There is an estimated 20 to 25 that are still alive and 50-some bodies. Those will all get released in exchange for 250 people, Palestinians serving in Israeli prisons for life sentences, as well as 1,700 Gazans that have been arrested since October the 7th, 2023. This would, of course, be pretty similar to some of the other lopsided ceasefire deals we've seen before. But again, according to the plan, Hamas members who commit to living peacefully in coexistence with Israel and laying down their arms will be granted amnesty, as well as, if they so desire, safe passage to a third country. What would happen with Gaza itself? Well, there would be an apolitical, technocratic Palestinian government established on an interim basis, not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority, although it would have the opportunity to be grafted into that in the future. Gaza would also be overseen by a new international transitional body called the Board of Peace, chaired by President Trump himself and including figures such as former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, although the details on who exactly will be made up are yet to be released. Sounds like there's a few more high-profile people that will go there. And it will govern Gaza until the Palestinian Authority agrees to certain reforms. Meanwhile, there will be an International Stabilization Force, or ISF, basically a peacekeeping force made up by friendly Arab governments as well as other international partners to gradually replace the Israel Defense Forces in the zones they control in Gaza. That part is extremely notable because even if Hamas doesn't agree to a deal, and at the time of recording, we're recording this Wednesday, Hamas has said it's unlikely that they'll accept it, but they haven't ruled it out yet. The ISF, this new peacekeeping force, will take over from the parts of Gaza that Israel and its defense forces already controls. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to this, so even if Hamas doesn't agree, it looks like we will be seeing a peacekeeping force coming in and making progress on the day after plan, making progress on what will replace Hamas. Now, it's notable for this in that much of the Muslim world, including some of Hamas's biggest sponsors like Qatar, like Turkey, like Egypt, they have reacted favorably to this and are reportedly, according to unconfirmed sources, urging Hamas to accept this deal. Now, for Netanyahu's part, this looks very similar to plenty of other deals that President Trump and President Biden before him have tried to pressure Israel. He would much rather go in and finish the job. But at the very least, if things fall apart, he now can say that he agreed to everybody's demands and he can push forward. President Trump said that if Hamas fails to agree, he will give his full backing for Israel to finish the job. He said that several times before, so that implies that he wasn't being serious when he said it before, and who knows if he'll be serious now. But either way, just with this peacekeeping force alone, just the fact that Israel is signing up to a deal, at least on paper, that all these other Muslim countries that don't like Israel are also saying yes to, suggests that finally, after almost 2 years of fighting, we may actually see some implementation on, again, what happens after Hamas in Gaza. Well, what does the Bible have to say on what happens after Hamas? We talk about Bible prophecy on this show, and this is the land of the Bible. This is the Holy Land, and the Bible does have prophecies relating to Gaza. It even names that city in prophecies relating to this part of the world. The pertinent one that I'd like to focus on today is in Psalm 83. It details a coalition of nations that come together for, as verse 4 says, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. The rest of the verses detail all these different countries that are going to be part of this alliance. It reads verses 6 through 8, "The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre, Asher also is joined with them," end quote. Now, these are all various different peoples that lived in the Holy Land about the same time as ancient Israel and Judah. They, according to the Bible and according to other secular history, we cannot find a record of this alliance either for these particular peoples or for their purpose of trying to attack Israel and wipe them out off the map at all. And that's why Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Fleury has said that this is not something of a historical record. This is actually a prophecy for now. But it doesn't make sense unless if you know who these people are that the prophecy is referring to. This is what Mr. Fleury wrote in an article about 5 years ago now called "Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals." Quote, "The key to unlocking this prophecy is to know the modern descendants of these peoples, and God in this end time has supplied this key. Based on biblical and historical research and with God's inspiration, Herbert W. Armstrong gave a good general idea of which nations these peoples correspond to today, equating the Ishmaelites with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, the Hagarenes with Syria, the Philistines with the Palestinians, Gebal and Tyre with Lebanon, Moab and Ammon with Jordan, and Edom and Amalek with Turkey," end quote. And then the rest of the article mentions that Asher or Assyria, that's referring to Germany, country not in the Middle East, but still very much involved, we expect it to be. And this, I should mention, this is not just Mr. Armstrong or Mr. Fleury or anybody pulling names out of a hat. There's plenty of people that would agree with a lot of these at least associations. The Ishmaelites, the Peninsula Arabs themselves, believe, according to their Islamic tradition, that they're descended from Ishmael. The Palestinians, as I mentioned, Gaza was originally one of the Philistine city-states. It was where the Judge Samson was imprisoned. Moab and Ammon, the capital city of Jordan today, is called Ammon. That's after the Ammonites that history books will tell you that lived there. Expecting these Palestinian peoples to join themselves in this alliance to wipe out the name of Israel from remembrance. You can compare that with other prophecies that we talk about often on this program, like in Daniel 11, that speak of this German-led conglomeration, if you will, going to war with another conglomeration led by Iran. Mr. Fleury's written a book called The King of the South that details that. And because of that, we expected Iran and its allies and Germany and its allies, these moderate Arab states so-called, to be on opposite sides of each other. For years now, until this point, Gaza under Hamas has been part of the Iranian camp. It has been hostile to the West. It has been hostile to many of these countries. So we've been expecting a change there for a long time. This is what an older version of the King of the South reads, just one short sentence. Because of this, there may soon be some significant power shifts in Gaza. That's what the edition from before October 7th read. This is what Mr. Fleury writes in the new book, quote, "When we printed that edition of this booklet, Hamas was still ruling Gaza as an Iranian puppet state. To most people, no signs were apparent of any imminent changes to Gaza's status quo. But 8 months later, Hamas launched its October 7th massacre against Israel. Since then, to say there have been significant power shifts in Gaza is an understatement, end quote. Now, 2 years on, we could see the first steps of Hamas losing power in the sense that there is a replacement government made up by Palestinians, made up by people in Gaza, taking form with this peacekeeping force. And if by the time this episode comes out, there'll be more information. But if Hamas agrees to something like this, even if it's a few weeks later from now, then that'll progress even further. And Israel would be letting it happen. That article, Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals, Mr. Fleury wrote that in response to the Abraham Accords that President Trump brokered in his first term between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, some of these Gulf states, some of these Ishmaelite states that we expect to be part of this Psalm 83 alliance. And this is how he summarized that back then. Quote, "We all want peace, but sadly, these recent peace pacts have a deadly flaw. Biblical prophecy gives us deep insight into these agreements. It actually foretells that modern Arabs will unite, somewhat like we are now seeing. But they are prophesied not to cooperate with the United States or Israel," end quote. So that was, again, with the UAE, with Bahrain, countries that don't really have a history of going to war. In this case, we're seeing President Trump try the same formula out with Gaza, with the country that just started this recent war with Israel with the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. So, again, this is a developing story. The details on the ground may be very different by the time this episode airs, but keep watching Gaza. Keep watching how President Trump tries his peace negotiations with Gaza and Israel, and keep watching what replaces Hamas. Well, that's not the only story we have this week from the U.S. Putting out a peace deal with terror groups. On Sunday, the Taliban in Afghanistan released Amir Amiri, who was a U.S. citizen that was in captive in Afghanistan. It's the fifth U.S. citizen this year that they've released. Maybe not as newsworthy as some other things going on in and of itself, but it's part of a wider trend of us hearing rumblings that the Taliban and the U.S. are having normalization talks, that the U.S. may recognize the Taliban government as a normal government and treat it as a normal country again. And that they're releasing the citizen at the time these rumors are spreading suggests that if they're confirmed, these talks are progressing in a good way. This is the same regime, you fast forward over 20 years ago, that launched the 9/11 terror attacks. This is not a country that is having problems with the U.S. because of some misunderstandings or clashing geopolitical interests. They attacked a far more powerful military on the other side of the world that originally helped get them in power against the Soviet Union back in the 80s, for no other reason than because they saw them as a nation of infidels that heaven has ordained them to go to war against. They still believe the same thing. They still, I mean, you can just look at the policies on the ground, how they treat women now, how they even ban the internet now. There's still the same fundamentalist mindset there. And so for America to open up relations with this regime is, at the very best, extremely naive, and at worst could set up America for some even worse attacks down the road.
Well, I wanted to talk about a couple of major victories for Europe and basically for Germany in controlling Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe. And the first of these comes from Bosnia, where the president of Republika Srpska, this fairly autonomous region that covers half of Bosnia and Herzegovina, he withdrew from all official roles on Monday after a long-running dispute with the German High Representative Christian Schmidt. Schmidt is basically the modern equivalent of a colonial governor. He's chosen by an international committee. He's not accountable or responsible to the Bosnian people. And in 2023, Schmidt blocked a couple of Dodik's bills. Dodik ignored the veto. In February, Dodik was sentenced to a year in prison and banned from Srpska's presidency for 6 years. As a compromise, that year in prison, I think they got rid of that. But in August, the Central Electoral Commission stripped him from office. This raised the prospect of a major showdown, maybe even civil war, with the possibility that Srpska might try and split off from Bosnia and Herzegovina and join Serbia. NATO broke up Yugoslavia in the early 90s on the principle of self-determination, that each national grouping, each ethnicity should decide for themselves how they're governed and what state they're a part of. Now, though, polls in Republika Srpska indicate a clear majority for secession from Bosnia and Herzegovina and maybe unity with Serbia, but the principle of self-determination doesn't apply to Serbs, just other ethnic groups in Yugoslavia. And so now Dodik is out of office. Dodik's party, the Alliance of Independent Social Democrats, decided to give up the fight. Germany's Deutsche Welle called Dodik's resignation complete capitulation. And now Republika Srpska is going to hold new elections on November 23rd. Dodik continues to head the party. He's not out of the picture completely yet. But earlier in the month, we wrote, Germany wants to keep control of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Its position on the Adriatic Sea is crucial. But now the anti-German movement in the nation seems more powerful than it has been since 1991. Worse, this movement is backed by Russia. This is significant in the context of Bible prophecy. Scripture shows that Germany is trying to unite Europe under its rule, partly due to fear of Russia. And there may be more to this story to unfold, and it may even tie into the next story I want to talk about. But we see Germany's dominance over the Balkans continues. That's something really important to watch, and Mr. Flurry had a whole booklet on it, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. Because what Germany is doing here reveals a thirst for power that they've worked hard to keep hidden. And now you had a German colonial governor fire and successfully get rid of Republika Srpska's president. I mean, that's not to completely whitewash Dodik or anything of the sort, but it does show Germany's power and dominance and their determination to keep control in the Balkans. But also this weekend, and slightly related, you had Moldova holding an important election. So here we're into the borders with Romania, different part of the Balkans, but this election was very closely watched in a region that you don't often hear about on the news, because this was billed as the choice for Moldova's future. Were they going to choose the European Union or were they going to choose Russia? This is a crucial battleground between Russia and the West. And Moldova chose Europe. The pro-EU Party of Action and Solidarity won with 50.3% of the vote. That ever so slight majority is going to translate to 55 out of 101 seats in Moldova's parliament, because they have a minimum threshold you have to reach to make it into the parliament. So once you get rid of all the small parties that didn't make that minimum threshold, then this Party of Action and Solidarity do manage to get more than just a bare minimum of a majority in their parliament. Their main rival, the pro-Russia Patriotic Electoral Bloc, won just 24.2% of the vote. And the rest of the votes went to smaller parties that are kind of neither as pro-EU or as pro-Russian as those two main groups, generally falling on kind of a bit of a spectrum. Generally, those smaller groups slightly tilt towards Russia, but that is a bit of an overgeneralization. Ahead of the vote, both sides were accusing the others of trying to steal the election. Russia was blamed for spreading fake news, for buying votes, for calling in fake bomb threats in foreign polling stations. Meanwhile, the EU worked in more legitimate ways to try and boost their party. They worked quite hard to allow Moldovans living in the West, and those Moldovans living in the West are overwhelmingly pro-EU, to vote. They had over 300 polling stations opened abroad. And then two pro-Russian parties were barred from standing over accusations of campaign finance violation. And, accusations of campaign finance violations can be pretty fuzzy things at times. So both sides heavily invested in trying to get their side over the line. But has the EU won here now? Is that it for Moldova? They're in a European direction. Well, not really. Russia controls the Moldovan breakaway region of Transnistria that in 2006, they voted even to join Russia. And Russia has a few troops there as part of a peacekeeping force. That gives Russia a lot of leverage and ability to cause trouble. This is where I think it could tie in to the Bosnia story. Bosnia won, Germany won in Bosnia very easily. This seemed like it was building towards a major catastrophe and then all went away. That could be a testament to how powerful Germany has become down there. It could indicate some kind of quid pro quo, or that, you know, Russia, that really controls Dodik and Dodik's party, decided not to make an issue of it. In 2008, Mr. Flurry wrote, "I believe that Germany's leaders may have already agreed a deal with Russia, a modern Hitler-Stalin pact where Germany and Russia divide countries and assets between themselves. This agreement would allow each to turn its sights on other targets. Any such deal that may have been struck between Germany and Russia is a precursor to war." And the fact that Moldova hasn't already been integrated into the EU, while so much of the Balkans has, that could mean that Germany's already agreed to let Russia have Moldova. And that Moldova may vote to join the EU, but just kind of like Ukraine, we don't really see Germany busting a gut to make that happen. Now, that's speculation. And also, I think any such deal between Russia and Germany could be open to renegotiation after Russia has taken much longer to conquer Ukraine than I think both sides thought they would. Russia already got caught planning a violent takeover of Moldova. And we know that Vladimir Putin is pushing quite hard to expand his Soviet empire. Maybe Russia decided to kind of buy off Germany to calm everything down in Bosnia in exchange for Germany agreeing not to exploit this election and not to oppose Russia's continued attempts to try and swing Moldova around. Again, I think that's just speculation. But the idea that Russia and Germany have signed a deal, certainly I think we can be sure they will sign a deal. It seems very likely they've had some kind of agreement already, because these two powers have done that so many times in history, because they can expend vast amounts of effort fighting each other, or they can have some kind of temporary arrangement and expand their focus elsewhere. And Bible prophecy shows that Germany's going to focus initially on the Middle East and breaking up Yugoslavia, making sure they have a strong foothold on the Mediterranean coast. That's part of the rationale behind that. That helps them move towards the Middle East, have more influence on the Mediterranean and into Eastern Europe. And then we also know, we have our free booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Rosh, that talks about Vladimir Putin and the role that he'll play in Bible prophecy, how Mr. Flurry forecast years ago that he would try and bring more former Soviet countries into his empire. And we see him doing exactly that with Ukraine, and we could see more efforts towards that goal in Moldova. I don't think we've seen the end of the story there. So Bible prophecy shows these two both trying to expand. It does also show that eventually, just like in any other deal, just like with the Hitler-Stalin pact, they'll turn on each other. This isn't a meeting of minds. This isn't a friendly relationship. They don't trust each other, but they can do business with each other for now. But certainly that book that I mentioned, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, really exposes Germany's power, Germany's geopolitical thinking, their dominance, their strategy. And that's what makes what is going on in the Balkans tremendously significant. Well, one more story I'll get to from Germany. Germany decided to allow the army to shoot down drones. The Interior Ministry announced plans to give the armed forces legal authorization to shoot down hostile aircraft within Germany. That was previously reserved for domestic security agencies. It's understandable. Europe has experienced these recent drone incursions. But also, since World War II, the German military has been barred from domestic security operations. This proposed change is one more step in a steady loosening of those restrictions that were there for good reason on the German military operating at home. So this is another step towards German militarization and normalizing the use of its military. So keep watching that story.
The big story for Asia is that Russian President Vladimir Putin has just drafted 135,000 soldiers into military service. This is the largest autumn conscription drive for Russia in almost a decade, and it shows that whatever Putin may sometimes say to various Western leaders about wanting to end this war, he actually has zero intention of doing so. And it shows that he's preparing his military to keep on fighting for who knows how long. So there is a draft for the Russian military each fall, But the usual number of men for the fall draft is closer to 125,000 or so. So these 135,000 mark a significant increase. And this comes as Vladimir Putin has also recently recruited hundreds of thousands of contract soldiers to fight in the war on Ukraine as well. And then we also know that Putin is working to expand the armed forces to 1.5 million active personnel by next year. So he's clearly showing no signs of slowing down and is actually looking ahead, anticipating more fighting in the months and years ahead. We also heard a statement this week from Putin. This was during a commemoration of the third anniversary of Russia's annexation of some Ukrainian territories. And Putin said, "Our fighters and commanders go on the attack, and the entire country, all of Russia, is waging this righteous battle and working hard." End quote. So Putin is still trying to brand this horrendous war as a righteous battle, as some sort of godly mission. And I won't take the time here to enumerate the civilian massacres in Bucha, or the atrocities that have happened in Mariupol, or the staggering numbers of children that have been kidnapped by the Russians and illegally brought into Russia. But the evidence abounds, just showing that this is an extremely evil war of aggression, a war of choice on Russia's part. So I don't think we should be surprised to hear Putin trying to put God's name on his evil and calling it a righteous cause, but it still does turn your stomach to hear that. But these developments, Russia's massive draft and calling up tens of thousands of new soldiers and his insistence that God is on Russia's side, this all shows that Vladimir Putin's ambitions, 3.5 years into this full-scale war, show no sign of fading. And it shows that he remains as determined as ever to assert control over all the land and all the people that he can. And whatever may happen in the near term, biblical prophecy shows that Putin will emerge from this conflict politically intact and still leading Russia as an authoritarian ruler. And it shows us that he will go on to fight more wars, bigger and far more devastating wars in the future. One of the main passages that you could go to for some of the details about that are in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. There are many details in there all about his role in end time events. And we have a free booklet that explains all of that in detail, along with other related Bible passages. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And this is a booklet that we send out at no charge to anyone who would like a copy of it. So please check out our show notes for today's episode, or you can go to thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab there and order your free hard copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia. I also wanted to squeeze in a mention here of India taking part in some war games this week with Russian forces. This is taking place in the western Indian state of Rajasthan with hundreds of Russian soldiers participating. And so this is just more evidence of India moving further away from the West and from its longtime partnership with the United States and moving closer into the Russian orbit. It's very sad to see the world's largest democracy forging a deeper and deeper relationship with Russia, despite the fact that Russia is waging its horrendous war and actively working to dismantle the international order. But this is a development that same passage in Ezekiel 38 and 39 a little bit as well that I mentioned a moment ago shows that we should have been expecting all along. So we really should not be surprised to see the Indians drawing closer to Russia and even rehearsing to make war alongside Russian forces. And then one final story here about the Philippines and a 6.9 magnitude earthquake that struck there on Tuesday. This was in the central part of the nation in Cebu province, and there were more than 65 confirmed deaths in the immediate aftermath of this earthquake. And officials on the ground there said that they expect the death toll to rise considerably as the rubble continues to be cleared. So a devastating disaster there that has struck the central Philippines.
Well, thank you to all of our correspondents for sending in their blurbs. Thank you for bearing with us in a bit more rough and ready of a show than usual. We're going to take a week off, but in a couple of weeks, we'll be back with our regular Week in Review show. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Victor Granados for helping us stitch this together while they're on the road as well. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Until then, keep watching your world.